Give you a little bit of background of where this title came from. I think it was about 2 years ago, I was attending the Global Art Forum at Art Dubai, and there was a panel called A Century of Documentas. And it had Adam Simchick, Catherine David, Oke Nkor, and in the end, Catherine said something very interesting, like, why can't we just occasionally do something good? Like, what is it about this format of certain things having to happen at certain times? Like, whatever happened to the idea of just producing a great exhibition in a particular context at a particular time? And something that I find wonderful about all these panelists here, we have Milovan Farinato, Sandra Churchman, and Daniel Bauman, is that they have all basically innovated different forms of exhibitions that also have an intense intimacy, an intimacy with the artist, an intimacy with the audience, and they also deal with time and context in very particular ways, in ways that are very difficult to achieve in large-scale biennials. I'll introduce the panelists briefly, and then we'll go from there. Daniel Bauman, to my right, is the director of the Kunsthalle in Zurich. He was previously curator of the Adolf Wolfli Foundation, and he co-founded a Basel exhibition space called New Jersey in 2008. He's familiar with working with traditional biennial models. He co-curated the last edition of the Carnegie International, which was founded in 1896 and is the oldest North American exhibition of contemporary art from around the globe. In 2004, he started an ongoing exhibition series in Tbilisi, Georgia, which is something he'll focus on in his presentation today. And he also curated part of the 2016 Dhaka Art Summit. To my left, we have Sandra Churchman. And Sandra is a curator who founded CADIST in 2006. So some of you might be familiar. CADIST has supported and has exhibited a lot of works from its collection in various biennials around the world. And she still advises the collection on its acquisition, production, and dissemination. In 2013, she co-founded Council, which is an agency for collective research and art productions, she'll talk a little bit more about that moving forward. And she has a BA in Art History from La Sorbonne and an MA in Curating from Goldsmith. Further to my left is Milovan Farinato, who is the director and curator of the Fiorucci Arts Trust. And they produce some events, which one being the residential itinerant picnic, another being the volcano extravaganza, which happens in Stromboli. He also curates independently around the world, and in terms of working with traditional biennials, he recently conceived the Violet No as part of the programming for the 14th Istanbul Biennial. And the Trust regularly collaborates with biennials on production, and he's also part of the artistic team of the Dhaka Art Summit in 2018. And we have another colleague who couldn't be here today, Cesar Garcia, and he kind of posed a framework to begin this panel, which I'll read, which is, how do we determine the relevancy of the biennial and or large-scale exhibition events today? Is it still a viable opportunity for artists to produce and present ambitious and experimental work rather than just commercially viable projects? Is it still a productive platform for scholars to generate scholarship? Is it still an effective tool for curators to challenge the complexity of disciplinary and institutional relations and the purpose and function of the exhibition format? Considering these questions, this panel will present a set of case studies that hopefully will allow us to see how we can begin to imagine and bring into being new species of spatiality that disrupt the methodologies and logics of both site and time that are often mobilized by these larger exhibitions, allowing for new opportunities to support and engage with artists, writers, thinkers, while simultaneously transforming the responsibility of the exhibitionary form. And with that, I pass the mic over to Daniel.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dana and Mier, for getting me here. Is this the tool I have to use? Okay. So, here we go. In 2004, I started an exhibition series, which wasn't even conceived as an exhibition series, in Tbilisi in Georgia. And the reason why I did this was I was a freelance curator living in Switzerland, and I thought, should I add more exhibitions to the already existing exhibitions in Switzerland or in London or in Paris? And I thought maybe I could also do something else. There's enough going on. And I had contact to Georgia, asked Prohalvicia, the Swiss Arts Council, if they would support an initiative in Tbilisi, and they did. So I have partners in Georgia, Nana Kipiani, amongst others, Levan Chogoshvili. They were part of an NGO, small NGO of artists and artist historians. And I said, well, let's do an exhibition together. So we did one exhibition
which I was supposed to. And there were only Swiss artists because it was the Swiss Arts Council, and I had no idea what I would expect me in TBC. So we took the plane and went there and did the show. As you can see, it was a quite boring show. It's very classical, the way one would do in the West, right? In the White Cube. And that was the first lesson. Coming to TBC, there was no structure, there was no art world, there were no curators, no galleries, no magazines, no collectors. So all of a sudden, what we did with our language, we came with our language, installed that language or the artworks in TBC, and we found out it didn't make sense because the whole context wasn't there. That I found, okay, that's an interesting point of departure because it really questions everything we did. So I said, well, let's go back next year because it was a very interesting, nevertheless, a very interesting, let's come in. It was a very interesting experience, and I said, maybe we should go back because there is something there that we could build on. And so we did number two in a different space because the space we had before we can get that again. And this time I invited a group of Georgian artists, brought some works by other artists, and some Western artists came with me. One principle, very important principle, was also there's no transport. I wouldn't pay for transport because I think we pay, as curators, we pay too much money for shipping companies instead of producing pieces in the space, in the location, in the city, in the country. Because out of the production from a lot of interesting experiences, contacts, and energy. So you see John Armleder doing a performance. That was Warsaw by Wilhelm Sassnau. It was produced with fuses that one of the friends, the Georgian friends, brought from because he kept them from the civil war. You know, in the 90s in TBC there was a civil war, and one of the young artists had actually been a soldier there. So he kept some of the fuses, and that's how we could do it. So you see all these little moments of production, of doing things together, they started to create a kind of a magic, an interesting situation. Then we installed some art in public space. Oops. And then there was a performance by Kevler, a Georgian artist who got injected this medicine so that he would sleep for 24 hours. There was another performance, and as a friend injecting him the anesthetic thing, you know, that he got for operation for surgery, and he would fall asleep for 25 hours. We did a performance, grand openings with a lot of Georgian artists. Went back the following year for number three, a coaster by Georgian artist Andro Vekla. Had these pictures by Marika Satyani, Georgian photographer. Did another performance, more and more performances, did film nights. So that was an important moment. I brought some films from Europe, and they started to bring Georgian films. So in the 20s, there was a very vibrant art scene in Georgia, and they did a lot of interesting experimental films that nobody knows about. So that brought me then to a library, and in that library was it's closed, but there's a nice gentleman who opens it, if you call him. He brought out all these books about Georgian, about futuristic books from the 20s. So all of a sudden I discovered that they brought more and more material, and they said, you know, there was a Georgian modernism. We call it Georgian modernism. It's a chapter of Western modernism that was in between 1918 and 23. and nobody knows about it. So I thought, oh, there was a whole group of people researching it, so I said, let's bring it to New York. So we did an exhibition in a Casey Cotton Gallery presenting the fantastic Verne de Tivoli avant-garde. So all of a sudden, you know, you go to a place, you start an exhibition, you hang out, you get to know people, you meet artists, and you discover not only this, and you discover also a very important chapter of European or Western modernism. We went on 2007, we did more artworks in public space. We went up in the outskirts on a hill in TBC, had kind of a fictitious art center. We created like a fake center for contemporary art in TBC. And then, okay, wait a second. And then came 2008, and then there was war. There was war again because the Georgian had attacked south Ossetia, and then the Russians fought back. So all of a sudden you're facing a different situation, something that never happens in Europe. What do you do? What kind of exhibition do you do when there is war in the country? Right? It's something we have never to think about. So I went back just on my own that year because it was too unstable, and we did a small performance with one friend, artist, Gerard Patashuri, but I wanted to continue it. But I was too big, the risk was too big to bring people to Georgia where there had just been war. And then we went back in 2009, and that was somehow the end of that series. But what we decided, we don't rent the space anymore. We decided no more spaces. The only thing we do, we go into the city and do things in very different places. So there was a project outside in the social housing projects. I was in the library, a performance involving Georgian students. That was an illegal bar and an illegal wallpaper, or illegal. And then I left for Pittsburgh, and when I came back, I got the job at the Kunsthalle Zurich. And so there had been this big fantasy during all these years to create the museum without walls. Yeah, that's the basic structure for any exhibition, is walls, right? That's how we behave in a space, that's how we adapt ourselves, that's the main pattern to look at art, is walls defining a space, and within that space a thing called art happens. So there was this big fantasy, what would it be to have a museum without walls. So that's what we did in 2016. I went there with the Kunsthalle. We invited about 30 artists from Georgia, from all over the place. And we built on an empty lot above TBC. You see TBC in the back. They built this kind of structure. And that structure then was used for performances, for lectures, for film projections, for concerts, for DJing. Yeah, so that's a very fast run through this exhibition series that was never planned as a series, that was never meant to be a biennial either, but that it was driven by the question, you know, how do we bring art into a place, and also what the big question, who exactly, what is the benefit? Who gets what? You know, what do the artists get? What does the public get? What does the curator, for instance, get? What does the country get? What does the local community get? And so on. And I think it started in a naive way, kind of a naive way, and it found its way and had to become more and more precise by still keeping open the whole setting. And I think one key thing that's probably we will see with the others, and it's what also Diana already said, is this intimacy. It really worked because it was so small. We never invited, there wasn't much public there. It was basically the artists and their friends. But also we never collaborated with official structures because in Georgia that would have been way too complicated. We kept it very small, and I think that was the reason why it worked, and it created all these collaborations. It was almost like a big workshop. That's what it started as an exhibition, and while we did it every year again, I started to see that the whole potential was actually not putting painting on the wall or installing a sculpture in the middle of the space, but it was all the installing moment, the working together moment. So somehow the exhibition became one big festival, workshop, gathering, trying to do things, which was very challenging for visitors. So in the very last one, in 2016, you didn't know, as a visitor, you didn't know what you should do, because you came to that open space and people would hang out, somebody was doing something. And people got a bit angry about it because they felt lost. But I think that was exactly the interesting thing about it, that an exhibition where something happens and you feel lost. So those are all subjects to be maybe discussed later.
Thank you, Daniel. Now I'm passing the mic over to Sandra. Thank you. Do you hear me? Yeah? Great. Okay, so I will talk about Bergen, the Bergen Assembly, which I co-curated last year in November. So Bergen is a second city in Norway. It's rather a small place, and we spend about 2.5 months there. And the important thing to know about our discussion today is that the Bergen Assembly is the outcome of a big conference that happened in 2009 called or entitled To Biennale or Not To Biennale, where all the artistic directors of the main biennales came and gathered in Bergen to decide whether or not it was meaningful to do one in Bergen. Now the conclusion was not to do Biennale, but they did a trail that they called actually, I think on the website it's a perennial model for artistic production and research. So something that it experiments with the time frame of a Biennale. Now our edition, the idea with the Bergen Assembly is that every time they experiment different models. So in our case, they invited three artistic directors. Now, the three artistic directors were themselves collected. So they were about, I don't know, 12 people sort of co-directing different parts of the Biennale. It was a beautiful mess, administratively speaking, but manageable. So I will focus on the project we did with Tarek Atoui, who was one of the artistic directors who invited us to co-create the project. Now, us is a county, so it's a micro-institution that we co-founded in 2013 with Grégory Castera, another curator based in Paris. The idea of county is to curate projects that each of them assemble a group of people from different disciplines that all work towards the same social issue. So for 3 years, or 4 years, 5 years, we all gather in different places in the world where we're invited, and we try to unpack the issue that we work on towards the production of new works, exhibition, and publication. The project we showed in Bergen, so in 2016, is the result of a long-term inquiry that started in 2013 on the definition of hearing. Hearing in a very literal way. How can we define hearing that is not focusing on audition, on or ear? How can we define hearing that reconfigurates all our senses, that is expressed through our body, through tactility, so tactile sound, through vibration, through what we see and perceive. And so that was a long study we made for 4 years, and the outcome was presented in Bergen. So it's already there, it's interesting to see that the Biennale, the triennial in that sense, was one step of that research, and the first time that this research was presented to an audience. That research, since 2013, traveled in many places. So it started in Sharjah in 2013, in collaboration with a school for deaf students. So each step involved different individuals who were hearing differently. So we sort of involved a spectrum of people from profoundly deaf to hard of hearing to a normative understanding of what hearing is and so on. And each of them were involved in different ways. Some ways they were workshops, so students were participating in workshops. Sometimes they were musicians, so they were playing. Sometimes they were architects, deaf architects, so they were co-designing exhibition with us. So we're relying on expertise of all this group of people. So we traveled from Sharjah to MoMA PS1, then went to ZKM, to NPAC in the US. Each time with a different group, until Bergen. Now Bergen, it's open in September, I think, but we were there, as I said, for a year and a half on and off with Tanaka Tui, working with people there, so meeting school for the deaf, meeting students, meeting NGOs, associations, artists, musicians, sort of building our own public. And that's the way we work, but I think also it was interesting for the Bergen Assembly to think of a Biennale that constructs its public based on an initiative. So people who came afterwards to attend the Biennale of the Triennial were people who were not really looking at art before, because we spent so much time with them before. So yeah, this construction of an audience or a public was important. Maybe I can show the video. I brought a 3-minute video, and I can explain you what we did. So the exhibition took place in an abandoned swimming pool. No, I think you can bring this on after. So the idea was to create a social space that is almost an institution dedicated to hearing, to modes of hearing. So that's the empty swimming pool where there was a display of objects that all came from Bergen, so we didn't ship anything again, same thing. We went to different museums, anthropological museum, maritime museum, and all found different objects that relate to an imaginary landscape of sound. So shells, of course. Well. Then there was another room at the entrance, which we called the sort of care room, which was open on appointments. And you could come for different kind of performative sensoring practices, such as the sound massage. There was a bar. It goes too fast. And the central piece was inside the pool. So we're down there, where Tarek Atoui was showing an instrumentarium, so 8 or 9 instruments that were built along the process with people who are hard of hearing and deaf. And there are instruments that can be played and perceived by deaf people. So they all function from tactile sounds, texture, these are different panels of textures, each related to sound. They all, these are different tiles. There are marble involved, they're always playing with visuality, or with visual aspect of sound. And there was a final, this is the opening night. So every week there was a concert, which was the outcome of the workshop during the week. Robert Demeter, we met him over there. He's profoundly deaf and was conducting that evening a group of musicians, partly professional musicians from Bergen and partly deaf and hard of hearing. And Robert was conducting a piece that was composed by Pauline Oliveros, for whom you don't know her, she's recently died, but she's one of the main figure of experimental music in the U.S. from the 70s, and she came to Bergen to conduct this ensemble for the opening day. So the instruments that you see are the results, as I said, of this visit on and off to Bergen. Each instrument are co-conceived with people we met there. Students and professionals. And so at the end, what you see in this Biennale was, for us, it was just a social space revealing the social fabric of the city, revealing that the associations, schools, museums, there was a festival for music involved. There was a number of partners which were incredible. And in a way, more than work, we showed that fabric. Thank you.
My turn? Okay. So I think that I can speak about, I would like to speak about two projects, but I will speak just about one. The two projects are Volcanic Extravaganza and the other one is called the Mitraria Theater. And basically they are annual. They happen every year in two remote places, one in Stromboli, here in Italy, and the other one in a small village in Poland. They share something in common, like kind of modus operandi, the remoteness of both the location. In both the location, anyway, there is a kind of like strong or relevant art community. So it's like Stromboli has been like attracting artists for decades. And of course, filmmakers and like a very charged cultural place. And Rapka Koi is like the place where Paulina Loska lives, where she had made puppet theater, neon, the neon. So it's like, anyways, like a small village, but with like a pregnancy, you know, like a relevance of like cultural activity in visual art. And but I want to speak and elaborate just about Stromboli. And to start, I would like to show you a very short film by Rina Islam, which is conceptually and also practically our beginning with Stromboli. You haven't come? Yeah. I mean, it's very dark, there are different ones, but Stromboli is completely black, so you cannot capture now the nuance of the film of Runa. Mainly, they are like long take, vertically, horizontal, and then sometimes these like anthropomorphic rocks appears. I think that for Runa was like an attempt to try to rationalize, to create a grid for understanding the reality and then get lost. The last moment of the film, which will come very soon, is the only one in color, and the actor is her leaving the island. It is our beginning because when we went there with Nicoletta Ferrucci in 2008, we bring with us Runa Islam as like a test. We was like absolutely interested in the
scenario of this island in a naturalistic context in the element fire, which seems like banal but is very real. You know, there is like an eruption every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, depends from the period, but the fire is present. It's present the water, the wind, the ground. Stromboli is also a mountain. It's not just like a volcano. It is an island. So he was interested by the potentiality of having as backdrop of any kind of activity which we didn't know. And the title of this film is "This Much Is Uncertain," and that much was uncertain also for us. And so we want to. He was sure that Stromboli could have been like, like great backdrop for like an artistic activity, and we went there as like a test with Runa to understand what could have become. And Runa was attracted by the sand. All these kind of sparkling moments are like the sand of Stromboli, which is black, is very shiny because it's like a lot of mineral inside, and she studied the sparkling nature of the sand instead of like being attracted by the eruption or by more like epic aspect elements. So at the beginning was just like a gathering. We was inviting artists to spend time there, to share time, a sort of residency, not necessarily connecting production of work, but then all the artists that went there wanted to produce work in the island, in response to the island. So the first edition of the Can Extravaganza was in 2011, and it was like, again, a test to bring back all the production that was happened in the previous year in Stromboli in a sort of like a sequence of event, exhibition. Most of them was like mainly performative. And there was, of course, Runa, Joshka Matsuga, Rico David, Jessica Werbois, many, many different artists. Paolo Gonzato, Sissi, also several Italian at the beginning. Also now. And then from there, I mean, I don't think that there is like a kind of like rules. So I never wanted to have rules, but there are like some kind of recurrent element. And the recurrent element is that from the first edition on, we always invite an artistic leader. So there is like, there has been Mick Mouse in 2012, Lucy McKenzie in 2013, in 2014, Arun Mirza. In 2015, just me, because I wanted to capitalize on my experience in Stromboli, as like being there since 2008. And last year was Camilo. And during the year, became like much more similar to a small biennial, let's say. So that was the reason why I was thinking to stop it and not to do it anymore. And I was really thinking to make like a break, together with Nicoletta Ferrucci, of course. And then I decided that no, I can start again, do it in another way. So just keep the barefoot quality, the connection between backstage and stage, the continuity between conceiving, producing, and exposing. This all happened maybe in 1 week, in 10 days, in a month. Every edition is different, also in terms of time. But you know, I invite artists to come, stay there, enjoy, produce, exhibit, and exhibit. So this is this kind of continuity. The backstage became the stage. The art community that we create every year, because then the artistic leader is invited to invite himself or herself, other artists, or teams, or curators, or even the family sometimes. Lucy McKenzie invites also her mother, his father, the Uchida professor to give a lecture. So to be, for me, it is a, in a way, a sort of like, I think that I curate the exhibition of the artistic leader, not through his or her work, but through the his or her interest and connection, family, in terms of art. And then this small community collaborate. So the collaboration also between the artists, something that has been always like a strong characterization and like a spontaneous outcome of Volcano Extravaganza. And Volcano Extravaganza actually that is a title that I don't like it anymore, but because it looks like to be a bit simple or simplistic, which is bad, worse. But it started because we published catalog before the project started. And this catalog was like sort of like a memoir, like photographs of like all the artists that we invited stay there, not production, not, you know, just gathering together, big book. And I was intended to write a text about this memoir, and I create a character, in my narrative way. The title was The Kind of Extravaganza. I was trying to define the project and the time through the creation of a man, which was named Volcano, and his second name was Extravaganza. So it was the title of my text, and everything was the title of the project. And I think that was the time.
Thank you, everyone. This was really, really excellent. And I guess I'll just ask a few questions before I turn it over to the audience. Guillaume, something that you once said a few years ago that stuck with me was that the idea of empathy as being one of your curatorial tools, if that makes sense. And I think that is something that crosses over all three of your projects. And in that kind of vein, I would love for you to talk a little bit more about how you approach your mediating processes with artists. Maybe we start with Guillaume. Something that I found really impressive was your film screening program in the last Volcano Extravaganza, I Go Where I Don't Belong, where you guys went into the homes of people who actually live in Stromboli and made projects within them. You could talk about that, and maybe Sandra, if you can talk a bit about most of these characters you form for research, like with the lobster, communication scientists, and stuff like that, and Daniel, maybe talking about how your experience was getting in with the community and the community and all that. Let's continue on.
Last year, it was the artistic leader was Camilla Ross, and since the beginning I understood that differently from my vision was coming before, and it was like much more epic, kind of like performance on top of the volcano dancer, kind of like becoming like a unity by Mathilde Rosier and many other things. The vision of Camilla Ross was very much domestic, about domesticity, the concept of maison absolue, of like the danger and eroticism of distances, naufrage, Robbie Solitude, where I feel isolated inside his own world. And so I propose to Camille, why not to use as location for the or for part of the project the house of the Strombolian, which has been always like kind of like part of our audience, but never became like a participant. You know, a guest, not a guest, an host. And indeed, I found like a great welcome from mainly the people that was not from Stromboli, but decided to live in Stromboli, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, that are part of the inhabitants, which are like 200 max. During the summer, most probably they are like 100 during the winter. But most of them are the one that accept the invitation. It was not for Stromboli, but they feel to be Stromboli, and that is also one of the reasons why the title then of that edition became "I Will Go Where I Don't Belong."
So to answer your question, maybe I'll start with explaining what is an issue. As I said, we always work issue-based, in a way, rather than artist-based. But what is this issue? How do we define an issue? How do we start? We don't come with an already formulated question or issue. It's through time, through collaboration with artists and scientists, and people from the civil society, that this issue that we started to look at, that was first an intuition, starts to be formulated in another way, in a new way. So through the collaboration with Tarekat, we, in time, we understood that the idea of building new instruments was a radical shift in questioning the issue we're working on. Another part of the project that I didn't talk about led to a choreographic piece that was initiated through a dialogue with a deaf architect who explained to us that there was no language and sign language to describe sound. There's no, the vocabulary in sign language is in a way not precise enough to describe what, how they feel sound. So we started to work on that, and that led to a choreographic work. So, through collaboration with artists, we define what the issue is really about.
So, in my case, or in the case of the person in TV, I think what happened was there was a shift from the object to performance. I think when I started to do it, and it still is, it was a very object obsessed art world, and I think it still is, and it felt more and more boring. So, but in the very first issue of the exhibition, you could see there were like proper artworks, and that fell basically flat. And then by that time already, we started to do more collaborative things, and well, we all, and I think that that also joins what Milovan says and Sandra, I think what we then found out was that performance has this enormous potential to bring people together from all different horizons with knowledge. It doesn't matter where you come from, you can be part of a performance because somebody brings in a scenario that is actually open that way. And I think that was, it was very satisfying because when you go as a curator into another country, how do you connect with people? And that's one of the problems of the biennials is that feeling that every 5 years or every 2 years they fall down into a city and they are there for 3 months and then they're gone and nothing happens afterward. So how can you build up, how can you be more sustainable, to use that big popular word? But anyway, so one thing was going back every year. I think that is important. And the second time is to use that tool of the performance as a way to bring people together. And what it also creates, and I think I was particularly enthusiastic about, it doesn't create the product because you can't control it. You know, it's all, everything out there is so controlled because it has to be finished to be sold, right? But the performance is, it's all open. Sometimes it works, sometimes it fails. But it never fails on human relationship. And then I think that's the empathy moment you're talking about. That felt like, okay, that's a world, that's an alternative to that crazy art market that we were facing back in 2008 or 2004 or something.
I even like to segue into the next question is, with, you know, biennials, for example, a lot of them don't have production money and they're going to artists and asking them to make like, the biggest type of biennial art they can possibly think of. And artists think that perhaps being in that biennial will make or break their career, and there's this intense kind of expectation and pressure, not only on the artists but also on patrons and also on galleries who are expected to feed into this kind of system. And I would love to hear more, and you've all touched on this, but to hear more about your process of working with artists and how you built, like, your practice differentiates your particular projects and models from, you know, large-scale exhibitions and biennials. And if you can tell us a bit about how your collaborations unfold and what are the intentions behind the way you model these collaborations. Now, you said something about, it was a nice, I took notes, the backstage became the stage. And it's exactly how it felt for us in Bergen, in the sense that it was only when we had the swimming pool open and we started to bring instruments in and works in that the entire people, community, inhabitants, artists from Bergen started to come before the opening and inhabit the space. And it had started before the opening. And during the entire show, what you could see when you arrived to the swimming pool was musicians playing, rehearsing, So really the backstage, people having sun massage, experimentation, and all this was visible. And then, yeah, so that felt like there was nothing we arrived with, nothing we produced before, but everything that was made with people there. Okay, I'll tell you a question.
Not you though, you asked the question. But I think that apart from stage and backstage, which totally is like one of the stronger characterization of our project in Stromboli, but also like the rehearsal and the moment of performing, it's almost the same. It's like in front of the audience, whatever it, you know, which is the audience, the locals, the people that come, the journalists, the friends, the other artists, and normally the performer, who they are, the friends of the, you know, the other artists participating in the same edition, Nick Malmstrog, the stones of Andrew Vekko from the cliff in front of the house, and then was reading the letter to the father of Kafka with Pierre Giorgiatti in their Chinese improvised shadow theater. And there has been always this kind of like great choral emotion of like stop.
So we went with Sandra, we had lunch, and we discussed about a lot of things, and I think we shared this, I love art, you know, I love painting, I love objects, it's my world, but I think we all have the feeling that this, after all, it's a gesture of communication, right, an artwork is a form of communication, but it turned more and more into a gesture of exclusion, and because you only, you know, it became part of a world that defined itself as an extremely exclusive micro-society. And I think that the whole thing of participation, of being together, of enjoying things together, got lost. That was my experience, I'd say, the last 20 years. And I think what all these projects try to bring back is participation, all different forms, and also inclusion. And I think that was my experience in TBC, going to a place where there was no art world, or where the whole language was absent. All of a sudden that opened up, I could see clear again, I could see what actually can be done, and what needs to be done. So that thing, it's not a workshop, but it's not only performance, actually participation, sharing things, and discussing and sitting together.
Well, with that, thank you so much to all of you, and we would like to open the floor to questions if anyone in the audience has anything they'd like to ask. In terms of what you mentioned about the possibilities to construct the public or the audience, and I think in all your projects, this long-term engagement of the reoccurrence kind of allows to do that. But I would be interested in hearing more in how do you actually maintain this community, or how open this community remains through these reoccurrences, and what are the kind of relations that shape across the years and in different places. I think the very beginning of the answer is to consider that an audience or public is concerned about or by the issue that you're looking at. So that's just a way to keep them in the loop, is because first they matter, but the thing matters to them, and they have a form of expertise, of knowledge about that specific issue. So that's one thing. And again, about inclusion, is never to think that there's a hierarchy of expertise, that each of us, in a way, have a form of knowledge, know-how, that can be shared. So if you start with that ground, in a way, then you find so many ways to apply to evolve people in different ways, whether they are co-authors, mediators, or writers, or stenographers, and so on. But this can only work long-term. I have no answer for short-term projects. To me, this is the value of long-term, is that you have time to involve people and to convince them to take part, and the collaboration will be meaningful.
I totally agree with everything Sandar said, but in the case of TBC, it had strange effects, I must say. And that's the other very interesting thing when you do projects like this, that you land in situations which are far from perfect. And your show is, whatever you do, it's going to be problematic in some way. You don't have that problem in a right in a museum or in a Kunsthalle anymore. Nobody, you can do whatever you want, you're not going to run into troubles. It's like an established situation. So one problem in TBC was, for instance, that I think it encouraged artists to leave the country. Us coming there and doing these exhibitions, and they got in contact with all these people, I think they said, okay, let's get out of here because nothing is happening. You know, so that's, so you build a public, but then the public also doesn't behave the way you think they should. But it's very much step by step, and in my case it was a very small public, and I liked it. Like, it was meant to be a very small public, because otherwise we couldn't have had this intimacy. It was never planned to be a big public event, and I think that's sometimes the problem of the biennials. They are forced to go to be big, because there's so much money involved that you have to have hundreds of thousands of people. So there's a huge pressure that we don't have, and I think we're very happy we don't have that pressure.
As I was saying at the beginning, the public of Stromberg is quite in favor of contemporary art, because it has, during the time and even before the spiritual trust to start our project there, there was many artists living in Stromboli, so there was used to Marina Abramovic and Selmus to live there, so it's like a public which could be participating, but actually at the beginning was not much, let's say. There was like more supportive in terms of offering services, help, to employ them for like, and I think that after sixth edition, they started to be part of the performance, to really help the artists to come to see the exhibition, until last year when, it was also hosted by 15, 20 Stromboli local, open the house, cook for the audience, which was other Stromboli, or otherwise the people that just came to see the edition of Camilla Roth. So generals participating, but it was a process. Definitely it was not like that at the beginning. And maybe you, Diana, that came three times, maybe you can have seen a bit like change.
I'll take one more question if there are any, and otherwise let you go enjoy this beautiful day. Ben?
So, thank you all. Really enjoyed hearing more about these things that I knew some about, but hearing in detail. One of the things that strikes me that's very distinct from kind of the larger scale either biennials or public institutions is precisely about scale and permissions. Okay, so in each situation there's been bringing together, not in the first instance a public, but a group of artists, a group of people who are really focused on producing something, and then it ripples out. And so there's one question around sort of funding, which is, with foundations, is there something different that is achieved, that's possible, than with public funding? And the second question is whether you've noticed a change in the way that the artist works following this kind of quite unique experience, this kind of intensive set of relationships that happen in a place. Do you think that there's been an effect on the way that the artist then approach their work in the long term?
Okay, I lost the first question. Founding. I think that, definitely, as self-cipher, a sufficient organization, the Future Trust, didn't have the need at the beginning, potentially not even now, to ask for funding. This gives us like great, autonomy. Nevertheless, during the years, not the found came, but we start a series of collaboration with a private organization as Vinyl Factory, which was like a partner of the Future Trust in 2015 and 16, and now we became like kind of like sharing the helmet of the next edition conducted by the people. And nevertheless, also we are going to face also a public institutional collaboration, because the next edition of the Central Atlantic will take place in Stromboli, of course, but also in Naples. And thanks to the partnership and institutional collaboration of the Museum of Madre, Donna Regina, Westmeath. And that will continue even in 2018, because the following edition of Stromboli will move to Bangladesh as part of the Dakar Summit, and then back to Stromboli. And something that will be like, self-sufficient, but also definitely interested to find not limits, but collaboration also with institutions. It comes quite spontaneous at the moment.
So about funding, so Council is an independent, not the right word, is an institution that doesn't rely on its own funding. So each project has to gather a number of funding bodies, which are all different, from non-for-profit to companies to universities to museums. So it's a puzzle. But in the case of the Bergen Assembly, it's all public money, which is amazing when you think of a Biennale at the scale of the city of Bergen, which is the second city in Norway, to have all this funding for such an experimental format of Biennale, of Triennial, whatever it's called, is remarkable. Yeah? And about the influence on artists, I just want to mention that, and to reply also to your question before, for each step of the project, we bring people from one country to another. So we create a collaboration that lasts longer. So for instance, the person who helped us with the scenography in Bergen comes from the edition of Sharjah, which was 3 years ago, as an architect. The conductor you saw at the end, that we met in Bergen, just came to Paris to do a show with us on that same project. So I think that's where the influence has a long-term impact.
In the case of the TBC project, I just raise the money every year, and it was all different foundations based in Switzerland. And about the artists, I think that the most surprising thing was that the Western art, the artists who came with me from the West, it was hugely liberating to work in a place where there was no art world, because all of a sudden they didn't have there's nothing there. So you could do whatever you wanted. You were only surrounded by friends, and there was no pressure. And I think that I didn't realize it like only after 3 or 4 years. I realized what a big chance that is, that they can do something in a place where nobody is judging them. Because there's so much pressure on young, especially younger artists on all levels. So that became a place where, you know, they could fail. You didn't have to succeed with your project there. You could come do it, and sometimes it worked, and sometimes it didn't. But that was the great, and that exactly this created all this huge energy. It's not because it's success that it's a good final succeed, because it's a good final, because you're free to do whatever you want, and you're also free to fail. And I think that's what we all try to achieve, to offer these artists a space of freedom for their projects.
Thank you, everyone.